Thanks very much. It's a great pleasure to be here in Toronto. I thank the organisers of the conference for organising the event. It looks like a very interesting day. Just as a background to what I'm going to talk about in my presentation, I guess we're all familiar with the issue around longevity risk. And people are living longer, people are dying at older ages, lifespan's increasing. And this has been going on for 100 years, although in the last 30 years the trend has been quite significant. But it's not only been the trend of improvement, there's quite a significant volatility in that trend. So a lot of uncertainty in future mortality. And so we have to develop products that will help finance this risk, and the annuity markets are one of those markets designed to help fund that risk. But of course, behind these products, the insurers that issue these products need to have other risk management devices to help them manage risk, including their longevity risk. So reinsurance and financial markets are important in terms of managing the risk. So financial markets have a much larger capacity than reinsurers to absorb risk, including this longevity risk. And there are certain systematic factors about the improvements in longevity that make this a risk that can't just be diversified within an insurer by just pooling risk. And so we need to look at other ways of financing the risk. So we've seen, in fact, developments in this already. So JP Morgan have developed their Life Metrics toolkit, and also they've developed these Q-forward contracts, and they've been doing derivative-type deals on longevity risk. So they've done some fairly large deals, and there are deals in the pipeline. There was an attempt to securitize longevity risk. It didn't work well. It wasn't well-designed not so long ago. And so this sort of motivated us to have a look at issues around securitisation and the securitisation market for longevity risk. And before doing that, we wanted to have a look at some of the modelling aspects of longevity and understand the risk a bit better and see how the pricing of that risk works. Because when you have that reinsurance market and that financial market for longevity risk, it also gives you a price indicator for this risk. Otherwise, it's hard to know how to price this risk and whether there should be a risk premium and so on. So this idea behind looking at the modelling more closely and looking at developing financial products into financial markets under the structure of securitisation was one of the reasons why we're interested in this area. So what I'll talk briefly about today is just a brief introduction about models of longevity risk. Some of these risk models you'll be familiar with. Some of them have come out of the demographic statistical area, and some have come out of the financial area. And so there's really a need to try and merge those two types of models because they take different types of approaches. But really, when we want to manage this risk and understand how to price it, we need to have financial-type models in that financial model setting. The demographic-type models tend to be focused on different issues, projecting out expected mortality rates rather than looking at how you would price this risk in financial markets. We develop a little model for Australian data in a financial structure, and I'll explain that. We only look at the older ages. If you look at the whole age structure, then you need to have a more advanced modelling framework because the behaviour of mortality rates across the whole age range differs. Once you get up into the older ages, then in terms of the trends and the patterns, it's in some senses a much easier way, easier age group to model than some of the earlier ages because of the different patterns across ages. But I'll explain that, and you'll see that as I go through the talk. The other thing we're interested in is what's happened in terms of improvements in mortality is there's been a common number of factors driving mortality change that has meant there's dependence across ages in mortality. So the standard sort of assumption about mortality and when you're looking at longevity risk is that lives are independent. You know, my survival is independent of other people's survival. We go about our lives independently, so you know, we have a chance of dying and we die independently. And that's not correct. So over the last 100 years, but particularly the last 30 years, there have been common factors driving probabilities of survival. My chance of survival, your chance of survival, even here in Canada and me in Australia, are actually dependent because general economic conditions have improved. Healthcare treatment of different diseases, all of those things have improved, and they improve your chances of survival as well as mine, which induces a dependence between us. And that dependence is actually quite strong. And so we wanted to understand that dependence much better. And of course, when you have that dependence, when you start pooling risks, you can't just diversify that risk away in a life insurance company's pool, even though they may have a relatively large pool of lives. You have to go into other markets. So the reinsurers would pool that risk with uncorrelated risks from property and casualty, catastrophe type risks. Financial markets can pool that with other risks as well. So hedge funds would be interested in these types of risks, as they have been in terms of cat risk, in the securitization of cat risk, catastrophe risk. So I'll talk a bit about that. And so we've built a little model. The model captures trends. It's based on Australian data over the last 30, 40 years, and it captures volatility and dependence. And I'll show you the impact of that on projecting mortality. And then we look at structuring a securitization of a portfolio, and there are different risk profiles you can look at, and I'll show you the particular one we looked at. And then we have to calibrate the pricing. And what we do to calibrate the pricing, some people will look at the annuity market and have a look at annuity prices, try and extract out a price of risk. We've gone to the insurance-linked securities market. There are some mortality-linked securities out there, and there are catastrophe-linked securities out there. So we look at the mortality-linked securities in particular, as well as the catastrophe-linked securities, and we extract a price of risk, if you like, from that market, which we then incorporate into the pricing. So we've used a traded market for insurance-type catastrophe risks or insurance-related mortality risks to extract a price and then incorporate that into the modelling and pricing. So that's the framework of what I'm going to talk about. So just some brief introduction. The demographic models or statistical models go back a long way, but the model that's found a lot of credibility and use has been the Lee Carter model. And the Lee Carter model basically takes the mortality rates, it takes the logarithm of the mortality rates, and it says for every age there's a level of mortality that differs by age. So these AXs, there's one for each age, so it's like an average mortality rate for each age. And then it says through time, this mortality rate improves or changes by a factor that's common across all the ages. So the KT is an index of improvement in mortality. It's random, it's usually modelled as a random walk, so it varies through time, but it applies to all the ages. It's a common factor that induces dependence across all the ages. And the BX is the extent to which that improvement affects age X. So each age has an improvement, but this KT is a random factor that induces dependence between the different ages. And so when people have fitted this model to developed countries' mortality data, they find that this common factor, having this common factor, explains in terms of the variability of mortality rates about between 85 and 95% of the variation in mortality rates. So that means this common factor has explained a lot of the variation in mortality rates, which means there's a lot of dependence in mortality rates going on. It's a single factor model, right? So it's not as good a model as you would want because, in fact, mortality has been impacted by many factors. When you look at a careful analysis, and we look at this in our data, you see that there's many factors. And you can imagine lots of different factors affecting different ages. It's not just one factor affecting all ages, right? There can be improvements in medical care that affect just some ages, and so there are potentially many factors that would drive mortality changes. Now, the models that are more interesting and more useful are the sort of financial models, and they can draw on a lot of developments in interest rate and credit risk modelling that's happened in the last 15, 20 years, and they're set in the same sort of framework. They're more dynamic in the way they model mortality changes. So they look at mortality changes, and there's some expected change in mortality for different ages, and there's some variability, some random variability. And then there are factors that affect the change in mortality, and there can be multiple factors. And it's usually set up in a framework where you can look at pricing derivative-type contracts. So it's a framework that fits naturally with wanting to do some market pricing of this risk. It's harder to do it with a demographic model, so people who use those models and they want to do some market pricing, they'll generally use something called like a Wang transform. They try and transform the probabilities to some risk-adjusted basis, but it's all very ad hoc. Whereas in the financial models, you can build in a natural way of pricing in the market price of risk, if you like, of this risk you're interested in this case, mortality. And that's the framework we were interested in using. We used the older ages, as I said. We used the period 1971 to 2004. On the left is the linear mortality rates. As we know, they increase with age as you get older. But the other thing you notice gets more variable as you get into the older ages. And volatility is a very important factor when we look at the behavior of these mortality rates. And the other thing is the dependence. You can't see it there, but you'll see when I do the analysis, there is a strong dependence. And then on the log scale, and I mentioned about the log of the mortality rates used in the demographic models, you can see on the log scale it looks almost linear, right? So you get a better behavior in terms of modeling on the log scale. And if you look at the financial models, they generally model changes in the log, right? So they look at rates of change of mortality and model that. So you're on the log scale as well. So it looks better behavior. You still see volatility at the higher ages. On the securitization side, I guess hopefully we've learned some lessons from the credit risk area about structuring of these deals, and it's probably put a little bit of a stop on securitization type transactions. But if you think about equities, bonds, they're just securitization of assets in firms. So all the financial instruments that we trade on in markets are securitized instruments. And so securitization of this risk along with other risks is something that will transfer the risk into financial markets, and it has some benefits. And obviously in the credit risk area, apart from the problems that arose because of a whole bunch of issues around structuring and collateral and so on, it's a very valuable way of actually pooling risk and then getting that out to investors in a structured form that suits different investor appetite in terms of risk. So there has been an attempt to do some longevity bond securitization. It didn't work, and there were a whole bunch of reasons around why it didn't work. But the insurance-linked securitization market is becoming pretty large, so we've seen catastrophe risk securitized, a whole bunch of different designs around different ways of securitizing. We've also seen mortality, so Swiss Re very active in terms of securitizing mortality risk. And so we wanted to have a look at securitization of longevity risk and issues around that, particularly about the risk and the pricing of the risk. So the basic model that we've applied has been one where we look at the rates of change of mortality, if you like, the log of rates of change. Now, there are equations here, but I'll just explain what they're all about. Basically, this says changes in mortality, there's an expected change, this is the expected change, and the expected change has a linear relationship with age. If you look at the expected change in the historical data, you see that expected changes aren't as large for the older ages. That's what you plot, and I don't have the plots here, but if you plot for the different ages the rates of change over the last 30 years, and you'll see this in many different countries around the world, right? And we're looking at ages above 60, so the younger ages above 60 have had higher rates of improvement than the older ages, right? So it varies by age. So we allow for that when we fit a linear function, and it's an approximation to the pattern, if you see in the data. So we want a model that has not too many parameters, right? Lee Carter, for every age, there's a parameter. Well, there's two parameters, in fact. There's many parameters in Lee Carter. We want it to smooth, not have too many parameters, to get a parsimonious model that fitted the data reasonably well. And then there's a variability term, or this sigma term is a constant. In the data, it's not exactly constant, but in this case, it's proportionate to the mortality rate. And so if you were thinking about this sigma, it's like the volatility in an option contract. So sigma is the volatility of longevity risk here in this model. And for an interest rate model, this would be the volatility you would use for your option pricing, for example. So volatility for interest rate, does anybody have an idea of the percentage rate for typical interest rate volatility? 15 to 20%, right? If you look at interest rates and you look at options traded on interest rates, typical volatility in percentage terms, that sigma would be something like 15 to 20%. Has anybody got an idea of what it is for mortality? What do you think that number is for mortality? I don't expect you to know because I'm going to tell you what it is for the Australian data, but does anybody get an idea? Well, it would come as a surprise. Some people say, okay, mortality risk, you know, there's no variability there. Right? You look at the rates and look at the variability. The rates are relatively small, so the variability looks small. But if you express it in percentage terms, right, percentage terms, volatility, when you look at option pricing, the risk is captured in volatility, percentage volatility. Interest rates, 15 to 20%, well, this sigma, I'll tell you what it is, going to be much more than you probably think, right? Would anybody like to just have a guess what it might be?
65%?
Well,
you're in the crisis.
Really? Wow. Okay. So there's a guess, 65. Any other offers? 40%. Wow. Geez. God. Ooh. That's pretty high. Okay, so it's not going to be that high, right? It's not as high as interest rate volatility. Interest rate volatility 15 to 20%. Equity volatility on an index is typically 20 to 30%. Now, it turns out that mortality volatility is less than both of those. And I'll give you the numbers in a minute. The other thing we did was we allowed for multiple factors. Right? So not just one factor, like one common general economic condition improvement affecting mortality. We allow for multiple factors. We wanted to actually try and capture the variability in the historical data with multiple factors. So we actually do what's called principal component analysis on the error terms in our model, and we work out the number of principal components, and these are random factors that drive the variability, and they also induce dependence across ages. And so we estimate dependence through this process, and we capture the actual dependence in the data in the model. So here's the answer to the volatility. Sigma actually, for our data, turns out to be about 10%. 0.09 is about 10%. The younger ages, it's much less. It's maybe about 5%, something like that. But for the older ages, it gets higher. And so our sigma, and we've basically averaged across the older ages, is about 10%. And then there's a linear trend, as I mentioned, and it's downward sloping in terms of the age profile because the expected changes at the older ages are lower. And then we fitted the model, and these are the residuals of the model, and what you're looking for there is just random, no patterns, right? And I can tell you that if you do some statistical tests, there's no real patterns left here, significant patterns. So we've got a model that's small number of parameters, reasonably parsimonious, and reasonably well fits the data. It's only for the ages over 60. If you wanted to model the full age range, it becomes much more complicated because you have an age pattern that has an infant mortality factor, then an accident hump, maybe for the females a maternal hump, for maternal deaths, not as significant as it used to be, then senescence, old age, and then ultra-old age above 100, where it becomes a little bit more questionable how to model that. But, so we have this model, and it does a reasonable job in terms of fitting the data. And we're going to use that. It's set in the context of financial modelling, so it can be applied to what we want to do, and that's do some financial pricing of this risk in terms of the securitisation. So I then mentioned about the randomness, that volatility term. There's dependence induced in the model through looking at the errors, and it's basically done through principal components, so you may not be familiar with principal components, but if you have a covariance matrix of different random returns, right, if you're familiar with portfolio theory with a covariance matrix, then there are random components you can decompose that into that are called principal components, and they explain certain amounts of variation, and they have different impacts on different ages. And you can do this with interest rates, for example. So a typical way when you look at interest rate volatility across interest rates of different maturities, and you do this same principal components analysis, one of the principal components analysis usually the level, and the level varies, and that affects all the interest rates. One is the slope, right, and the slope can change, and one is the curvature, right, so there are different factors with the interpretation. And you can do something similar if you wanted to with mortality, right, so you have a mortality curve, and you could do something in terms of principal component affecting all ages equally, a common factor that affects level, another factor that affects slope, so it affects the older ages differently to the younger ages, and maybe some curvature, because you see curvature at the older ages towards 100 and so on. So you could do something similar. We haven't interpreted that way. We just looked at the, and we plotted the principal components from this, and you can see there are, in fact, you know, common factors across all the ages, and certain ages affected by other factors. Some of the later principal components, you might argue, are just random noise, because there's some variation in the data. Now, the Australian population is 20 million, 21 million, and at the older ages, the number of people who are alive is relatively small. If you work out the variation just from the fact that there's a small number of lives, it's probably about 10% of this variation, these older ages. So there's a component here that's just random variation. But the early principal components are significant. We actually model rates of change. Some of the people who model mortality rates will model the level of the rates, and they'll do principal components on the level, and they'll find that you only need a small number of factors to explain most of the variation. But actually the levels aren't what's called stationary. You need to take differences or look at rates of change when you do this modelling, and then look at what's driving the change. And you find there are more factors driving those changes, more randomness there. So you can see the first factor explains about 30% of the variation, and then if you have five factors, you've got 70%, 10 factors, 85%. So there's a lot of factors impacting the ages, and you can imagine different changes in terms of improvements in health treatment or particular drugs that affect particular ages and so on. But in the data, it tells you that there's more than just one factor like you would have in the Lee-Carter model that's driving this, and we're looking at the changes, not the levels, when we do the modelling. So we need a reasonable number of factors to capture the dependent structure in the historical data. And this shows the expected, under our model we then project out, and this shows the expected on the standard linear scale, and this is on the log scale, and this is probably more informative. So if you look at 5 years out, and so what we've done is simulated the model out for 5 years, and the black line was the starting point of the data. Right, so these are the mortality rates in 2004, right, and this is after 5 years we simulate out. The blue line is the simulated expected mortality rates, and it's from age 60 out to 100. So the blue line, so you can see there's mortality improvement. Now at the older ages in the data that we had, it showed a decline in mortality at the older ages. We haven't included that, we've actually kept the mortality rate from our model increasing out there, so we've made an assumption there. But then these dotted lines are the level of uncertainty around that expected, so they reflect the volatility, right? So back down at these younger ages, from 60 out to 80, there's not much variability, there's not much risk. So a lot of people, when they talk about longevity risk, they say, oh, well, you don't worry about out to 85 maybe, there's not much risk there. But 85 onwards, then the risk becomes much more important, and it increases with age, right? So you can see the uncertainty in that rate is much higher the further out you go. This is after 20 years, so we simulate after 20 years. Here's that same curve here, starting point. Here's the improvement that's been built into the model, and here's the uncertainty. And as you can see, the uncertainty now after 20 years is much larger for these younger ages, and quite large when you get out to the older ages. So the model captures the historical data in the trends and the variability, and it reflects increased uncertainty in the rates out to the older ages, and it reflects an improvement, an expected improvement, based on the last 30 or 40 years in terms of the expected mortality rates. So, what we were interested in is having a look at a structuring of a longevity securitization, longevity bond. So the structure is very much the same as any type of securitization. If you looked at CDOs, credit risk securitization, or any mortgage-backed security or whatever, same sort of structure, right? In this case, we're looking at an annuity. So we have a life insurer and issuing annuitant-type products, whatever they may be, but generally life annuities, but could be the life longevity component of a variable annuity or whatever. So here's the life insurance company. So there's a special purpose vehicle established. Now this is the important thing in terms of credit risk, a collateral account, and this is where the CDOs somewhat went astray, because you know you don't want this to be a AAA collateral account under the control of some investment bank that's doing funny things with CDOs. You want this to be in government securities, and you want it managed by someone who's going to be reliable. But provided that works, you have a fully collateralized setup here, so the credit risk is removed, and then all you're doing is you're passing on the longevity risk into financial markets to investors. Now, some investors don't want to take on too much risk. They want a lower level. So we have three tranches. You could have more, but here's a senior tranche. So these guys want relatively safe but slightly above risk-free return. Here's the mezzanine investors. They're prepared to take on more. And here's the equity investors, right? So that might stay with the insurer, or at least part of that. But typically, you want to have the control of moral hazard issues and all those things by structuring this so that there is some skin in the game from the issuer, so that there's the right incentives in terms of running the structure. But what we do basically is accumulate the what we call losses, and the losses are based on our forecast mortality. Now, JP Morgan forecast mortality with their life metrics. We have a model also, so we've used our model to work out, if you like, the expected cash flows on a portfolio, and the portfolio you securitize depends on what the portfolio you're interested in. So this is designed to actually hedge the actual payments of a particular life insurance company, but you have an expected based on the model, and then you have actual, and if the actual exceeds expected, then this thing has a loss, and that loss goes to investors, and you accumulate the loss for the maturity of the security, right? So you just recognize losses when actual exceeds expected, you accumulate them, and then they get passed on to investors, and you pass the losses on to the junior tranche first, then the mezzanine, then the senior. So that's the waterfall structure in the securitization. But the idea is to base it on expected from the model, and then you then have actual payments, and if the actual exceeds expected, in other words, people living longer, then those are recognized as losses, and they accumulate through the maturity of the bond structure, and then you just allocate them through the investor structure until the total face value is exhausted. And that's the deal structure. And it's typical of these securitizations. And we just used an example to illustrate. We were particularly interested in the calibration, which I'll talk about next. But, for example, we just used a portfolio with an even number of lives, about 2,000 lives at each age, across the whole age range, because we wanted to have a look at the impact of dependence, age dependence. So if you just looked at, say, a group of 60-year-olds, one cohort, and followed them through, you wouldn't really get the full impact of age dependence on the results. So if you look at different ages in a portfolio and then do the modelling, you get the impact of dependence, which is what we're interested in. So it's an annuity portfolio, and we had a maturity of 20 years. It could be longer, but that was the structure, and we used the three tranche. We want to basically illustrate the idea. So as I said, what we did was the first tranche would take the first 15% of losses, the second tranche 15 to 30%, and the final tranche the rest. And then this is a simulation of the cumulative losses in our example portfolio, and you can see here's the senior tranche. They only get hit by a few of the simulations, so this is where there's a lot of mortality improvement. Then this is the mezzanine tranche that gets hit by some, but the equity tranche takes a lot, right? So there's quite a bit of losses, and in fact, you know, you expect to pretty much lose your money here. And that's why a lot of this would stay with the issuer. So, and then pricing, it's the same way as you would price a CDO. It's exactly the same idea. The only thing is you have to allow for the mortality in the pricing. So it's the same sort of structure. There's payments both ways, and you price basically so that it's a fair price. And you do that for each tranche, and that's the same way you would price a CDO. Now, this is for the financial mathematicians in the group, but I won't spend much time on it. But basically, when you simulate out and you want to look at losses for capital purposes, then you estimate from the historical data and you simulate out and you get distributions like I've just shown you. And that's for risk-based capital. What's happening in the future? But when you want to price, you need to risk adjust, right? So this is exactly what you do with option pricing. You need to change your probabilities to risk-adjusted probability. It's called change of measure. And so you have to do that here, right? So we've simulated out with our model, but we now want to risk adjust and do some pricing. And so we need to somehow get a price of risk for this mortality risk and do some pricing. So we need to do a change of measure. Now it turns out that we have a multi-factor model, so we actually need a price of risk on each of those factors. And the problem is when you go out into the annuity market or the securitization market for life products, then you can't price all of those risk factors. So you have to reduce things down and try and do it a little bit more, well, let's say cleverly. And that's what we try and do. But basically the idea is there's a risk factor for each of those principal components in theory, right? And somehow you need to determine what that is. But what we did was we went to a particular market where this type of risk trades, and we extracted a price of risk based on a particular model that gets used in that market for pricing. But you need to change measure somehow and get a risk-adjusted price, and this is how we did it. Oh, well, this is not how we did it. I'll do it in a second. This just shows cumulative losses and how they affect different tranches. And what we did was we used the model with dependence from the historical data, and then we assumed lives were independent, and then we assumed lives were fully dependent, just to see the effect of dependence. And so this shows some plots where we have cumulative losses and confidence bands around those losses, and this is for independent lives. This is for our historical data, and this is for fully dependent lives across the different tranches. And I guess the important thing to note is that even in the independent case, there's still variability, right? There's still uncertainty, right? You don't lose all the risk. It's still there in terms of just the amount of variability varies in terms of the assumption we make. This then just shows the tranche losses. So this is for tranche 1 here, tranche 2, tranche 3, and it shows the losses according to age, the losses that occur on age. Obviously what happens is most of the losses are going to occur on the older ages, right? So you may in fact get some benefit on the younger ages, and they may offset because of this dependence, right, structure. And so this just shows the impact across different ages. Some ages you may benefit from and some ages you lose from. And this just shows that structuring. So it's interesting to look at the age profile of losses as well, because that's obviously one of the things you should be interested in. Now, here's what I was going to talk about for calibration. There's, an insurance-linked securities market. It's been underway for 8-10 years or so. Sometimes it's more active than others, competes to some extent with the reinsurance market or complements it. But how you actually work out those prices in that market in terms of risk prices is interesting. There are mortality linked securities that trade out in that market, so there's mortality risk that gets traded and priced, and we wanted to extract from those prices the risk premium that we could use for pricing these securitisations. Now, Morton Lane's sort of an expert in this market and has various models, and different people have different models, but he has a model that basically says the price is the expected loss plus some risk premium. Now, in this market, the risk premium is generally multiples of the expected loss. So if you go, even if you look at reinsurance, the cat risk, you work out the expected loss is right out in the tail. Right, so these are tail risks, and the risk premium is multiples of the expected loss. Right, so if you had an expected loss not so far out in the tail, the risk premium would be much less. Because the expected loss is out in the tail, and you're taking a part of the tail. It's like the options, if you're further out the money you go, then with the volatility profile, you're getting higher premiums. So here is the risk premium, and he basically models the risk premiums depending on probability of loss and the loss, if a condition on loss occurring, the actual expected loss. And he finds that this model doesn't do a bad job in terms of fitting the market risk premiums. He recalibrates it every so often, and the parameters change a little bit, but basically it makes some sense that you would expect that the risk premium would reflect the probability of loss, how far out in the tail, and the expected loss when a loss occurs, and that's the structure that he used. So what we do is we look at the market and we estimate parameters based on the market data around the time we were doing this work, and from that we're going to use a similar structure to look at our tranches. So we'll look at our tranches and we'll look at the probability of loss and the expected loss given a loss occurred, and we'll take that from our tranches, and then we'll take that tranche with these characteristics and put it into this market and say what price would that generate in the market, and from that we can infer a price of risk for the different tranches. Right? So we look at the tranches, we have a look at their characteristics in terms of these factors that drive the insurance-linked securities market, and then we go to the insurance-linked security market and say, if this was a security with these characteristics, how would it price in that market? We would take that price, and then what we do from our model is we say, what's the price of risk in our financial model that's implied by that price? So we take market data, we take a market model that some people use, we use that to calibrate a risk premium, and from that risk premium we extract the market price of risk in a financial model. And that's basically what we've done. So this actually shows for our different tranches under different assumptions about dependence, the risk premiums in basis points. So here's the equity tranche, here's the mezzanine, and here's the senior tranche. And this lambda star is the price of risk. Now, the way we actually calibrated this lambda star, it's like a Sharpe ratio. Are you all familiar with Sharpe ratios? Right, excess return over a risk-free rate per unit of risk, right, per unit of volatility. Excess return per unit of volatility. So what would be a Sharpe ratio for the equity market? Does anybody have an idea? Typical Sharpe ratio for an equity market? Or an equity stock, it varies a lot, but does anybody have an idea of what? Well, maybe 0.8. It varies, right? So some stocks might be 1.2 or something, but it might be 0.7, 0.8, something like that, Sharpe ratio. It's excess return per unit of risk, a risk-based price that's normalized, standardized. So you can see, here's the equity piece. And their Sharpe ratio is 2.52, here's the mezzanine 0.31, and tranche 3 is 0.25. So one tranche here would be, you know, really quite a big equity risk exposure. These ones very much lower, right, as you would expect, based on the structuring. But this is extracted from taking our tranches, working out probabilities of loss, expected loss when a loss occurs, calibrating them in terms of the way they would be priced in the ILS market, and then extracting from our model an equivalent price of risk that would be used for pricing in the model. So you can now, based on these characteristics, price other securities using these prices of risk, if you like, because we have a way of calibrating from the insurance-linked securities market into our model framework, and we can price then other securities and other structures. And this just shows some alternative prices of risk under different assumptions about age dependence. So this is independence of ages, this is our historical dependence, which I just showed you, and this is full age dependence, and it shows the variation. So it shows the impact of dependence, and dependence is important. So when you're modeling this and understanding risk, it's important to understand and model the dependence between ages, and there is actually dependence, and you can understand that in terms of historical data. So just to wrap up, we're interested in having a look at this securitization longevity structure. We're interested in a sort of parsimonious model that captures the trends and the uncertainty, and we use Australian data. And we wanted to try and calibrate our model to market data in the insurance-linked securities market. And we want to understand the price of risk and try and relate that to a financial model in terms of calibration. And can I do a plug? Since I've been talking about longevity, there's a conference next year at the University of New South Wales, it's actually close by, in September, on longevity risk. This is a conference that's been going on a while. It's the sixth one. We're focusing on reinsurance and financial markets and the government role in terms of should the government be issuing longevity bonds or whatever to help insurers hedge this risk. And there's also the World Risk and Insurance Economics Congress in Singapore, if you want to go down to another part of the world, and that's in July. But some references if you want to talk, and otherwise, questions.
Yes. No doubt, but the Jack model is probably flawed for interest rate derivatives, and I think there are much more realistic models to apply, or have you any like future research, like using, for example, CIR kind of model?
Yeah, we're actually, I've got a research student, we're actually working on some affine type models, and as particular cases are the ones you just mentioned, but there's been, I guess in the interest rate area, the development of these affine models, we're looking at applying that into the, and people have done this already with mortality risk, longevity risk. So we're actually doing that with the Australian data. We're modelling the survival curve, like a yield curve, and using affine models to do that. Yeah. But you want something parsimonious. If you use the sort of demographic models, you have so many parameters. And this is one of the reasons why they explain so much of the variation in the past data, because they have so many parameters, right? You know, if you give me more and more parameters, I explain more and more of the variation. And you think, oh, what a good model. Well, it's maybe not such a good model. Yeah. Yeah, that we haven't done that. That would be really interesting to do. There have been people who have calibrated models to life annuity prices. Yeah, we haven't done that with our model, but it would be interesting to have a look. And yeah.
Do you know what they concluded, or you know, the different by market, or
in terms of the annuity, the risk premiums on the annuity? I think in the annuity market are definitely different. But I'm not sure how they've exactly done what they've done and how to compare. But I'd imagine the life annuity market to some extent will be driven off reinsurance, particularly in the old ages. No? So reinsurers aren't offering reinsurance on annuity portfolios? Well, that's So that, well, the capital they have available is relatively limited compared to the financial market, which is another reason why we'd would hope that there would be an active financial market. But you need a way of determining that price, right? If you're just sitting selling this business and you don't know how to price it and you don't understand the risks, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, they do deals. They do large deals, and they do deals with this risk and other risks. And
they,
yeah, yeah, that's right. They're not as large as the... Yeah, yeah. And the reinsurers do this stuff as well. But if you look at the way reinsurers price cat risk and so on, it's very similar to the way, for example, Morton Lane's model works. And there's been... Yeah, yeah. Sure. Yeah. Exactly.
Any other questions or thoughts from the audience? I was wondering, Michael, given that we have a number of PhD students in the audience, if you can give some thoughts in terms of research areas that continue this line. So if you were a PhD student starting out, you had 2 to 3 years of work ahead of you, where would you focus attention in this area?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, I think on the modeling side, we need more work. We need to understand modeling better. We need to, for example, this has just been based on historical data and aggregate age-based data. We know within age groups, for example, that there's a lot of heterogeneity. We know that mortality is impacted by your work, your income, education, a whole bunch of things. And that in each of those age groups, some of that variability comes from heterogeneity. Right? So this is, you know, everybody doesn't have exactly the same chance of dying. It's like an average chance of dying, right? So there's heterogeneity. So understanding that, but also understanding those factors and their impact on mortality. And when you start looking at modelling into the future, understanding the risk factors better, I think, is important. But also things like what are those factors and what's driving those changes? And you may be able to link that to cause of death and changes in cause of death. So we've seen, for example, the primary causes of death changing through time, affecting different ages. So it's seen improvement, but it's come from improvement affecting different ages. Right? So infant mortality originally, then sort of middle group of ages from different drugs to manage disease and, you know, heart disease and so on, and maybe, you know, cancer's been pretty constant through all of that. So when you look out into the future, understanding the causal factors, I think. So on the modelling side, those sorts of issues. But I think really we need to put some attention into the financial models, the financial framework, because, you know, as the market does develop, and the financial markets will no doubt take on this risk, and we'll probably need that in terms of to develop an annuity market or a longevity type market at the retail level, then we need to understand the risk pricing better. So understanding financial modelling, some of the... Well, I guess we're lucky that a lot of the developments have happened in interest rate risk modelling and credit risk modelling, so we can borrow a lot of the ideas there. But the longevity risk is a different type of risk, so we need to understand the particular features of how to use those models and how to calibrate, right, and getting risk factors. And I think they're probably two areas that are worthy of time being spent.
Follow up on that. Assuming this market actually develops, we have, you know, longevity bonds that are robust. Do you see that eventually the prices of annuities will improve, controlling for interest rates? That people will be getting better deals 10 or 15 years from now as this market evolves? Or will it be offset by improvements in mortality?
Well, I think, you know, I think in the if you look at what's happened, for example, in the UK where they have quite an active annuity market, they're starting to use, for example, for underwriting purposes for annuities, postcode. Right? So we've just been doing some work in Australia where if you look at geographical variation in mortality, and they've done this in the UK, right? So they actually look at marketing firm data and they see, and you can imagine it, right? In certain suburbs, all the wealthy people live there with the high education, and close by around those suburbs are people who are also fairly wealthy, but maybe not as wealthy as these guys, good education, right? And certain migrant communities live in certain areas, congregate in certain areas with certain employment, right? And so there are all these socioeconomic factors that affect, and they tend to aggregate in geographical locations. So postcode actually turns out to be a very good proxy for risk factors that affect your survival probability. So, okay, you underwrite based on postcode. You'll have a different rate, annuity rate, for people living in different areas. Right? And we've started doing some work in Australia looking at socioeconomic grouping. So the Australian Bureau of Stats have these areas, and they collect census data, right? So we can actually go back a long time with census data, and also they have death data by cause of death data going back a long way, and it tells you where people live and the characteristics based on household. So we've started to have a look at that, and what you find, of course, is that you could just do the geospatial modeling and have what's called a frailty factor, that it just reflects the variability according to the mortality in the geospatial model. And then you can bring in all these factors, and it turns out you don't need all the factors because the geospatial stuff captures it really well. And so if you wanted to do rating, you could use that, for example. And so this would give you a way of handling some of those factors. I think there's a lot of developments that can happen to give a more fair annuity pricing structure at the retail level, understanding those risk factors better. And like I said, there's heterogeneity, but this can distinguish some of that heterogeneity. At the moment, you're only probably getting certain postcodes writing business if you had a look at your portfolio, because they're the people who would be buying the annuities who live in a particular area. And it happened, you know, the UK, the US, Australia, and I'm sure it's the same here in Canada.
Any questions?
Yeah, no. It's,
well,
in the UK, there are marketing firms that collect, and census data and surveys, but particularly census data, they gather all this socioeconomic data for marketing purposes. They go to these companies and they say, oh, you've got a product that's this, that, and that. Well, you need to pitch that to the young, wealthy Ferrari drivers, and they live in this suburb or whatever, and we can tell you where to pitch it. And these people read these newspapers. So the people who are doing the annuity type business are now realizing, oh, they can use that. Right?
And,
you can get the mortality. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, see, in the UK, a postcode is probably, you know, 10 houses. It's different in Toronto and in Australia. Is quite different. A postcode is large. You really have to probably get census data that is at household level and aggregate. And to do that is, well, expensive, and there are privacy issues. We just doing what we've been doing, we've had, working with the Australian Bureau of Stats, we've had privacy issues. There's no privacy issue because we can't tell who lives in what house or whatever. But yeah, I think, you know, it's really interesting to know. You know, you don't think about that, but when you look at the data, you know, it just jumps out at you. And that's what they're doing in the UK. And if you can, you know, identify houses in small groups, right, and you can identify their characteristics, you know, the census data, for example, and the death data, cause of death data is collected, and you know where the people live, the details all there. It's a matter of putting all that together. Now, that's, some people get worried about that because, you know, Big Brother is finding out all this information about us and whatever, but it's happening.
Any other questions or comments? I'll take my brother and ask one last question. I guess from a research point of view, students that are interested in pursuing this line of research, how much can they do on the modeling side without having an understanding of the biology and the aging process? Is it purely statistical, or do you need to understand that?
Most of the research to date has been exactly that. You don't really need to know much about. But I think increasingly that's going to be more important. I think it's reached a stage where modelling at the aggregate level, doing by age and trends and so on, that's given you an understanding of the risks and so on, but to understand the projections going further out, you really have to understand the factors a bit better. And I think that requires attention. I think if you start looking at that, you probably get different results because, for example, one of the things they do is they look at the expectation of life, right, and they plot it, and it looks linear across all these countries since, you know, after the Second World War, it just looks linear. So we just extend it linearly, you know, we'll keep increasing our expectation of life. Well, you go back and look at what's been happening, right, you may not want to do that because expectation of life has increased because we were, you know, clean water and better health and so on affecting everybody, but also things in terms of infant mortality, and then it was the middle, and now it's the older ages with treatment for heart disease and so on, right? But can you rely on that still going on? Maybe not. So I think you really need to go back, and you've done a statistical model, but built into that statistical model is some things going on in history that are, you know, mixed together, and you're missing that. And unless you go back and look at it, I think, you know, you want to be a bit careful. And I'm guilty. That's what I've done, and that's what people do. But I think the next step is to do it a bit more carefully. Yeah.
Well, let's thank Michael very much. The schedule is as follows. Outside, there's going to be a buffet lunch served for everyone, and we're going to be here promptly back at 12:30. So 50 minutes from now, at 12:30, we're going to start with the afternoon session. Remember, we'll be done here today by 2:30.
Take that out. Which one is it?
Probably this
that
one.
Top one, yeah.
A question just occurred to me. Is there an area of research to be looked at in terms of different parts of the world? I mean, I presume that mortality is, and it also strikes me that insurance businesses are growing in some regions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that's an area.
We've looked across developed countries and looked at the potential to diversify across countries, and we started doing some stuff on that. This PhD student in Germany is doing some stuff on that as well. But yeah, I mean, we started just looking at developed countries, right? But I guess you can broaden that because the patterns in lesser developed countries are quite different. So there's potential for, but they don't have the money to buy annuity products and they're